Accession number 20272, Reel 4.
Bridges Arms, Reel 4. So, do I understand that a key role was played by this surrendered enemy personnel leading them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Without him, we couldn't have started. He knew it all. Except, as I say, he knew it. He knew where the camp was, but what he didn't really know was how to get there. Even though he'd been a member of that group. He was a high-powered CT, this fellow.
Why should he have been so willing to act against his old company?
That I couldn't say. I don't know. I mean, you have to go to a special branch for that. I couldn't tell you.
But did you have faith in him?
I had to, for God's sake. I mean, he was the chap who was going to lead us to this camp. He actually showed us where he thought it was, but in actual fact, it wasn't quite right. And in the jungle, when you can only see a few yards, you've got to get it right. And if we hadn't heard the sound of chopping and the voice, I doubt if we'd have found it. But I don't think I could have cordoned it either without him. Don't think so. I mean, it was nothing to do with me. It was him. But I just led the troops.
Obviously, he could have been leading you into a trap.
I doubt. Not a force like that. There weren't enough bandits to do it. No. He was having a cushy life. He was well paid, I think. You know, he'd come out, surrendered. This is what they call an SEP. Surrendered enemy person.
What was your own attitude towards the enemy?
What was mine? Well, I suppose I thought they were bad. But I've been living anti-communist for a large part of my life. Bricksmith was anti-communist. When I was in Prague, I was anti-communist. When I was in Vienna, I was anti-communist.
When were you in Prague?
I was in Prague, 1950, the former layer, 52 to 54. I was assistant military attaché technical in Prague, and I have no technical knowledge whatsoever.
So what were you supposed to be doing?
Anything. I was an attaché's job is to keep an eye on the other country's army. In civilized places like France and Germany, you'd be invited to go and visit, but not in a communist country, you don't. You just have to motor around and hope that the boys are in barracks or not in barracks, and you meet them on the road and you can see what sort of equipment they've got, etc., etc. Or you can go to the Queen's birthday parade, well, the communist premier's parade, and see what sort of equipment they produce and report back to London. Lovely life. I had 2.5 years in Prague.
What impression did you gain of the regime in Prague?
Typical commie. You could tell. We lived in a house. We had what they called a Dumovnik, a houseman who was there, lived in the cellar, who kept an eye on us. I mean, everybody kept eyes on everybody else. It was communism. Got used to it. Same with Vienna when we were there.
How did the population in Prague seem to be faring?
What a coward. Card. But a lot of them had never known anything else, the young. There were a lot of British wives there from the war who had married Czech flyers in this country, and they'd gone back after the war, and every year at the embassy on Queen's birthday, all these wives were invited into parties. The parties, you know, and to see their faces was absolutely astonishing.
In what sense?
Well, the difference between us and them. That they were living in these towns in a communist regime, whereas we were living in a town but not under a communist regime in the embassy. That was the difference. I mean, when they saw the spread of food and the fags, okay, one old girl had so much she died at one of the parties.
From overeating?
Yeah, overeating and over smoking and over drinking. And she had come 4 days from Kozice, which was down in Slovakia, up to Prague to get to the party. Came every year.
And where had she come from? Where
originally? Somewhere in this country. Yeah, she'd married a Czech during the war.
Now, if you can go on to Bricksmiths, please, yeah. And if you can tell me what it was, first yeah. of all, and how you came to be in it.
Bricksmiths, the full title was the British Exchange Mission to the Soviet Forces of Occupation Germany. It was agreed at the end of the war that there would be missions from the British, French and American on one side and the Russians on the other side stationed in each of the zones. So there'd be a Russian mission in the British zone, French zone and American zone, and there would be a British, American and French missions in the Russian zone. And it was all agreed by Field Marshal, where he was at the time, 1946. And it laid the the instructions laid down, the number of people were and what the host nation would provide, basically. And they were there to look after the interests of the nationals who were in the other zones. Absolute rubbish. They were just there to keep an eye on their enemies. Well, on their allies, who might be their enemy. And who got the best of that? Those who, the Russians, who were in the British, French, and American zones. Whereas we were followed, we were, not all the time, but we were, under suspicion, quite rightly from the Russian point of view. And we lived some lived in Berlin, in the British sector of Berlin. They were the single people, but the marrieds like ourselves and all the soldiers lived in Potsdam, where they had a sergeant major, and we had a couple of horses there. My wife and I had a flat there. The colonel had a house. The brigadier had a house. The colonel had a flat, and the G1 had a flat, I think. And one of the RAF officers had a flat there with his wife. My wife was allowed to go to Berlin once a week from Potsdam shopping, and we could go to Berlin once a week for entertainment, like a visit to the officers' club. Though Alex Yates was the RAF officer who was the interpreter with me. We played cricket in Berlin, West Berlin. We played hockey in West Berlin. We, the officers, had quite a pleasant time. The soldiers, well, they were travelling around all over. They were drivers for us who were going out, keeping our eyes open as to what the Russians were up to. It was a very restricted life. I suppose it, later on, of course, it became much more professional than we were. Chaps used to break into. I only got this from the book on the history of Bricksmiths. Break into barracks, Russian barracks, and all sorts of stuff they got up to. But we didn't. We were gentlemen spies.
Did you see much that would have been of much use, do you think?
Oh, yeah, we did. Oh, yes, you couldn't help it. We used to cover the zone, the Russian zone, by touring round the barracks, and you were bound to see stuff that was moving in or out of the barracks. You'd see them on the railway. Right outside our camp at Potsdam was a big railway centre where they offloaded their tanks and their guns and everything. I mean, it was all what we saw, and we could photograph. I tell you, one of the funniest things that happened to me, we had a naval officer there, and his job, of course, was to keep an eye open on the north coast of eastern Germany. And one day a signal came in from the Admiralty to say that there was a boat in Rostock, I think it was, where it had a peculiar superstructure. Will you please go and have a look? So the tours were always one officer like that and one interpreter and a driver. Well, there were three interpreters. There was me, Alex Yates, and Staff Sergeant Hardesty, Royal Army Paid Corps. And we used to accompany these active officers, like the naval officer. And we had one Air Force officer as well. And we set off to have a look one morning. We went about 4 o'clock to go to Rostock, to the port, to have a look at this ship that had these particular things on the top that the Admiralty didn't know about. Now, I should explain that at that particular time, the robot camera, which was a tiny little camera, came into being. And we had robot cameras, and we were a kind of a trials unit, I think, for the robot. Which all you had to do was to press like that and just kept on doing it. So we took a robot camera with us. But what we forgot to do was to read the instructions of the robot camera. And when we got back, we had a squadron leader in the RAF who did all the processing at that time of a film. We handed the Navy chap handed the film in for processing, and the following morning we got a message. I went back to Potsdam. The following morning, Colonel Meadmore, who was the deputy, asked me to go up to Berlin, which I did. And he wanted to know why the results of the camera work had been so bad. Well, as I didn't know what the results were, I couldn't help. So I went to see McPhee, Squadron Leader McPhee, about it. And he said, well, what had happened was that though we had pressed the 36 and got rid of all the film, we'd failed to take the cover off the lens, and so we had 36 blanks. And as a result of that, Colonel Meadmore said, disgraceful, he said, you will go again. And he said, you will go tomorrow, and you will take with you the camera and all instructions. So off we went the following morning, 4 o'clock. Got to Rostock, same place, same ship, same superstructure. Beautiful. Was. And we left at 4, so we got there early. And so I read out all the instructions for the naval chap to do. And unfortunately, I've forgotten what it was, but there was one thing you had to do with it. I believe that was the one, that's right. It was the second time. McPhee had failed to write down, take off cap. I know what had happened the first time. He had written, take off cap. And so we did all these things, all these points. I ticked them all off. And the old naval commander got the bloody thing, and he was tootling away like mad. And back we went to Potsdam. Following morning, come up to Berlin. Up I went to Berlin again. What had we been up to this time? He had got, 36 photos of sky. He had named them. you can laugh now, but I'm talking about late 1940s, when cameras of that, you know, other than a simple little Kodak, nobody understood. And what we'd done, we'd had two marvelous trips up and down, and we hadn't got a sign of anything that the Admiralty wanted to know about. I tell you, it was unbelievable.
Were the photographs eventually obtained?
Yeah, oh yeah, we got them. Oh yeah, no problem. Yeah, no problem. Got it right. Well, I'll tell you another trip we did. Not boring you.
No.
There was a Lieutenant Colonel Agamirov, who was our opposite number in Potsdam, who was the chap who looked after the mission from the Russian side. He was a liaison officer from Marshal, whatever his name was, down to us. And he one day said to me, I'd like to go. He said, I'd like to go and see how you crossed the Rhine in 1945. He said, because I was G1 of a general staff officer, grade one, in a Russian division that did the crossing at Pristine of the River Oder. And he said, I'd like to go if I could at the time of year when it was done. Well, because straight away everybody in Berlin was suspected something very odd about this request. And in fact, it turned out to be not odd at all. But the narcs in Berlin couldn't know this. So they hummed and hawed about putting poor Al Agamirov off. Till the brigadier one day said to me, Jimmy, he said, go round and see Agamerov and say that we've got it under control, but as the time is coming, it was in April, when the Russians crossed the Oder at Kostrin, perhaps we could go first and then we'll put him on afterwards. So I went down to see Agamerov and he said, yes. He said, I will personally take you there. So the brigadier and I and Agamerov went off to do this, stood on a fort overlooking the Oder at Kostrin, while Agamerov told us exactly how the Russians had tackled the river crossing and all that sort of stuff. We thanked him very much, and on the way back, we were going across a plain, which then rises to go into Berlin, where there'd been a great tank battle. And in the distance, the brigadier said to me, what's that tank over there, Jim? I said, I don't know, brigadier. He said, well, go tomorrow and have a look, will you? So the following day, I went out. I know what happened. I went the following day and I didn't know what the hell it was. So I wrote a report for London about this tank. Well, MI, whatever they were, 10, I suppose, in those days, wrote back and said they would like to attach an officer to the mission who had knowledge of tanks, because they're very interested in this thing, and they thought the description was... They wanted more detail in this thing. They thought perhaps it was something new. So a chap called Tom... Oh, God, what's his name? A Royal Engineer, he turned up. And he was attached to the mission. We got him a special pass and got him attached. And then he and I went off to do this. They wanted measurements. So we took a ruler and a bit of string, and that was about it. And one of these things where you could measure angles, what they called
protractor.
I mean, that was our equipment. And we went off in the middle of nowhere with a troop of French driver. He was the driver to this bloody tank, where we measured everything inside. And went back to Potsdam.
What were the Russians doing?
Not a person inside. It was just a great big plane. It was a tank that had been ruined, been hit during the war. And we went back, and we went straight, instead of going back to Potsdam, went straight into the headquarters in Berlin and wrote the report on it. And that evening, what was his name? I've forgotten his name. This captain said to me, Jim, have you got the pencil or the protractor or the ruler? I said, no. And he said, well, nor have I. So he said, I wonder if French has got it, the driver. So we got hold of French. No, French hadn't got it. Well, of course, what had happened? We'd left them on the bloody tank. So we went, we rang up Colonel Meadmore, and he said, come and tell me. So up we went to Berlin. We told him. He said, right. He said, you've lost it. Go and find it. So off we went to this tank. There wasn't a sign of the ruler, or the pencil, or the string. Somebody had been, must have seen us, and pinched it. Whether it was Russians or what the hell. It must have been Russians, because no German would have had a car in those days that would have been allowed to go anywhere near there, I think. Yeah, that was the sort of thing we got. I mean, they're much more professional. Became much more professional afterwards when you read the history of Brixmas, but in those days it was astonishing what we did.
Could you have been pulled up any time by the Russians?
Oh yes, we had. Oh, we were pulled in. We had a pass. See, we had a pass signed by the chief of staff. They were known by his name. What the hell were they called? Anyway, so all you had to do was to produce this pass, and the Russians would let you go. Well, what they normally did, they wouldn't let you go. They were so suspicious, they would ring Potsdam to find out if everything was in order. And it was well known that nearly every time you were pulled in, you were always going to be there for 2 to 3 hours, because it took about that time to get through to Potsdam. And so you had to be a good chess player, because you were always invited by the Russians straight away. Do you play chess? And then you used to sit down and play chess while waiting for the call to come back. But what was fascinating about this Soviet pass was that when we went into the British zone, where we didn't have any British passes, because we weren't in BOR, we were part and parcel of the group of Soviet forces, Germany, GSFG, to all intents and purposes. All we had was a Russian pass. When we used to get there, they used to the British police used to pull us in. they thought we didn't know what we were with this Russian pass. It was amazing. And when we came back in, we always had problems coming back into the zone with the Russians because half of them couldn't read anyway. They couldn't read. Astonishing. I tell you.
What impression did you get of the Russian army then, as a whole?
Well, they must have been pretty good. But I think that they chucked. I think they were. I think. Who was it? Chuikov. Chuikov was a marshal. He was the head. I think Chuikov was the head man there. He was a rough, tough cookie. By golly. I think. Because they had the manpower. And I think also the Germans, there's no doubt about it, outstretched themselves like Napoleon did, going for Moscow on such a broad front. Basically. And that's not me speaking, that's historians. They were quite amusing. My wife had nothing to do. We had no daughters. We'd only been married a few months. And she speaks good German. She used to walk around, when we think it over now, alone in these parks in Potsdam, where any Russian could have easily jumped on her, you know. She couldn't speak any Russian. And the first time she went into one of these places, she noticed a word saying pectopan. She said to me, "What is pectopan?" I said, "Write it out." So she wrote it out, pectopan. I said, "Oh, that is a restaurant in Russian. You speak Russian, too."
I know that's a restaurant.
Yeah, restaurant in Russian. Yeah, I tell you. But she seemed to enjoy it. I think she felt restricted by not being able to go to civilization more frequently than she did. That was it. That was Potsdam.
I think you also served in Jamaica at some stage.
Yes, I did. I served there in 1957 to about 1959. And I was second in command of the 1st Battalion, the Royal Hampshire Regiment.
Was it peaceful?
Yes, it was. Oh, except for these Rastas, a Rastafarian sect. The Rastas had a thing. They just wanted to. They had two aims in life. One was to go back to Abyssinia and be set up by a king, whatever his name was in those days. And the other thing was to get rid of the British from the West Indies. And they were. They were cane cutters, basically. They were not that we had much to do with them. Till one day the CO went down. The battalion was spread all over the Caribbean. We had people in Bahamas, British Honduras, British Guiana, and Jamaica, but the bulk in Jamaica. Nearly all national servicemen, with a few left who had served in Malaya. Amongst the NCOs in particular. And one day, the CO went on a trip down to Georgetown, British Guiana, to see A Company. And it was a two-day trip because he had to change planes at Trinidad. And it was, we were talking some time ago. And it took him 2 days to get back, that's the thing. And while he was away, the brigadier sent for me and said, "Look, we've got a problem. We know there's a gang of Rastafarians. We're not sure exactly how many, but we think they're big enough to cause trouble. And they're somewhere, got a camp somewhere in near Kingston, Jamaica." And he said, "How are you off for troops?" I said, "Well, I've got B Company here, and I've got Headquarter Company, and that's all." I said, "Because the other companies are out on in these posts." Well, he said, you can rattle up if you have to." I said, "Oh, yes, we can provide troops." He said, "Well, the problem is to know exactly where." And on a map on the wall, there were three likely positions of a camp of this gang of Rastafarians, who I think, I'm not sure what they'd been up to at the time. But anyway, they had to be eliminated. And so what they did, I think the G2 was blindfolded, and he pressed into the map. I think they twiddled him around so he didn't know which camp was where. And he pressed, and it was decided that where he pressed would be the camp that we would cordon and search. for these Rastafarians. The trouble was that, besides not knowing where they were, we had, as I said, very few people who knew how to cordon and search. And they were the people who were left, still regular NCOs, who were still in the battalion, who'd been in Malaya when it was a cordons and search. So we had to kind of, well, we just had to rely upon what we had, basically. The sergeant, the regimental sergeant major was a good chap, he'd been there. Private Goodenough, my friend, had been there, the chap who trotted on my head in Malaya. He was now the battalion gardener. So I arranged with Major May, who commanded B Company, that his company was the only company there, had this little operation to do, and would he hold himself ready to go and deal with this camp? Well, it was decided that there should be no waste of time. We should go straight away. So the boys went out to this camp, B Company, and they were going to cordon it. And the way they were going to do it was they were going to have one person facing that way into the camp so that any Rasta coming out would be seen and could be shot. And they had one chap going facing the outward way in case that Rasta got away and he would be shot this way, right? Well, as they put the cordon in, we lost two chaps killed and both rifles pinched and six magazines worth of bullets gone as they burst out of the camp area. They must have heard something anyway. So there we were with the whole company, with two dead, our own chaps, and this gang had gone. So I was sent to the CO. Hadn't come back from Jamaica, from British Guiana. He'd been told what was happening and he was coming back, but he was still somewhere over the Caribbean. So I went with the RSM and Private Goodenough to this camp area. I don't know why we took Goodenough, but we did, with a spade. We were looking for documents or something. When we got there, because there was nobody in it, it looked just like a bandit camp in Malaya. Here, Barnard, the RSM, said to me, "Sir, what do you think that is?" So I said, "I don't know." He said, "I can tell you what it takes to take a bloody cow." So he said, "A good enough dig." It's a good enough dug, and there were three bodies in there, in that cave, in that grave, and they'd all been killed by this Rasta gang. So the word went out that they had to be found. The CO arrived back from British Guiana. And he said, "Jim, what the hell's going on?" So I briefed him up. And the battalion, it was then decided that the West India Regiment, who shared a barracks with, I think we shared the barracks with them, after all, they were the locals, would have a chance. Because we always seem to get the best things there. And after all, they were a very nice bunch of chaps. They were too good at cricket for us, but I mean, they were, other than that, they were all right. And they were given the task of hunting down this gang in Jamaica. Well, it lasted a fortnight, and eventually they were cornered by the West India Regiment, who then shot them, or no, captured them. I think they had a couple of dead, not themselves. And these chaps were tried, and they were all sentenced to death. And that ended all the excitement in Jamaica at the time.
Which year was that?
June. I went to the German Staff College in 1960. That must have been 58 or 59.
Otherwise, was it a good posting to be in?
Oh, not the troops. Not from the troops' point of view. There was nothing much to do in Jamaica, except you could go to the Blue, where there was a relief centre in the Blue Mountains where it was cool. That was okay. Kingston itself was a terrible place as a town. So the troops were really confined to the camp. I mean, you don't have to worry about the officers. They had a club and a swimming pool. But the troops, they had a swimming pool, but they had, say, 300 to 400 chaps in the camp. It was difficult to keep mocking.